Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
And so it's a contemptible situation that we live in when Goebbels Jr. is allowed to come to this country and build a temple in this country, a temple against the will of the 70% of the people. A temple to what? A temple to division? A temple to hatred? A temple to drive one religion against another? Because that's what he has done. With a little help from Bloomberg and the stupid left-wing comedians in the American media. That's your Mr. Ralph. And so there it is. He talks about terrorism. And he says that we are the terrorist nation. And you know, when you have an impasse like this, it's called war. When one side says you're the terrorist and this side says you're the terrorist, eventually what happens is the two sides go to war. And yet we're told now that the man spreading that gospel of hatred against America is a man of peace, a man who wants to bring the races together. We're told his wonderful wife, Daisy Khan, who is as uncompromising as they come. She won't submit to anyone's opinion. It's only her opinion. I want that mosque and I want it built there. She says, and you're not going to stop me. And anyone who stops me is a bigot. Anyone who opposes the mosque is an anti-Semite on steroids. Anyone who opposes the mosque is un-American, she says. Therefore, Nancy Pelosi jumps in, the genius herself, and she says that we should conduct an investigation of all those who oppose the mosque. So the Democrat Party now joins the fanatics and says that they want a McCarthy-like witch hunt of all those who oppose the mosque. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very important case. I realize many of you don't want to hear it anymore. You have to understand how important this is. And one of the reasons this is still ongoing is because it is not over yet. It came out, as I said to you, that these people are in it not only to promote hatred, not only to go back to their home countries and show a great trophy of victory that they built a mosque literally on the ashes of 9/11, but now they're going to use public funds to do it. Turns out that they found a way through Bloomberg to use public funds to build the Ground Zero Victory Mosque. The Muslim Center, they're calling it. Now it's a center. Planned near the site of the World Trade Center could qualify for tax-free financing. A spokesmouth for Bloomberg said, and his spokesmouth is willing to consider approving the public subsidy. The Democratic Comptroller spokesman Scott Sieber, another super prize of humanity, said that they support the project. It says, if it turns out to be financially feasible, and if they can demonstrate an ability to pay off the bonds and comply with the laws concerning tax-exempt financing, we'd certainly consider it, said Mayor Bloomberg's spokesmouth Sieber. Now, the mosque's backers hope to raise a total of $70 million in tax-exempt debt in order to build the mosque. Tax laws allow such funding, listen to this, for religiously affiliated nonprofits if they can prove the facility will benefit the general public and their religious activities are funded separately. The general public. Now, wouldn't the general public include Christians, some of whom eat pork? Wouldn't the general public include the large Chinese community in the lower Manhattan who love pork and other such products? I would say that if these fine examples of humanity who are behind the mosque would agree to permit a Chinese deli that hang various products from the butcher shop in their product of their products in the public center, I would say it would benefit the community at large. Did you hear what I just said? Tax laws allow such funding for religiously affiliated nonprofits if they can prove the facility will benefit the general public and that their religious activities are funded separately, separation of church and state. So in other words, how can you justify, how can you state for a moment that this mosque, which is being masked inside a community center, a public center, will benefit the general public, when in fact you know that the very same Muslims who are behind this would say no to the sale of any pork or pork products in such a general public center. So now you understand that there's big money behind all of this. We showed you and disclosed on the Savage Nation the connection to the Middle East that Bloomberg has. His expansion of the Bloomberg Empire in the Arab Muslim world goes on. This is all tied into his desire to placate his friends in the Middle East. Majority of Americans losing faith in Obama. That's a sad story because he's a young man. He's a young man. He wasn't given a chance, and it was the white cracker racists in the Tea Party and those nasty Republicans who stood in his way. I mean, if you listen to CNN and the New York Times, if only there was a single-party system, Obama would be very popular. You know, I mean, you know, let's be fair about it. If Obama could only have rounded up all of the opponents of his socialist policies and put them into internment camps, his popularity would be 100%. Just think about that. It's those nasty people, the crackers in the Tea Party, who oppose him. So when you read a majority of Americans losing faith in Obama, you got to take that with a grain of, well, I guess, salt. You got to realize it's because of this nasty, disgusting two-party system that those white racist founding father crackers created. Think about it. That's right. They created a cracker system called a two-party system, by gosh. That's not democracy. True democracy is electing an unknown man with shady money passed from Chicago and giving him absolute power with no checks and balances. And then you'll see if this man could perform without these stupid people on the right always putting him down. I mean, he's trying hard. Him and Michelle mean well. So what did she drink champagne and eat caviar in the White House at your expense and has more personal assistance than any first lady in history? That shouldn't matter. She's making up for past iniquities. She's making up for past iniquities in the system, so she's personally enjoying it. That's the important thing. It's not that the sharecropper's grandchild enjoys it somewhere in Mississippi. What's important is that she enjoys it and he enjoys riding around in Air Force One. And these crackers who are putting him down, they're the real problem. If only this wasn't owned by a cracker nation and a cracker press, Obama's ratings would be 90, 100%, maybe 110%, like in Uganda under Idi Amin, where there was no opposition. Or the Fidel Castro, where there was no opposition. That's the problem. The problem is that the country has not yet got that private civilian national security force that Obama talked about during the election, run by his own people, people he can trust, a private national security force just as big, just as powerful, and just as well-funded as the U.S. military. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Two little stories about drinks. Because everybody drinks every day, whether it's water or alcohol or something else, juice. I saw an article on where your bottled water comes from. You know how the yuppies are always sucking from a water bottle like infants? They always have to have like a bottle in their hand, always sucking on something. Every minute, another bottle. Wherever they go, they carry it. I even saw a judge in a courtroom the other day had a big, long, black holder for some bottle of water, like some big moron. He had to have his water bottle. He had to have his water bottle, a judge. You hear this? The yuppie judge. Everyone has to have a bottle to carry around, like an infant. So they all think that tap water is no good for them. Not, certainly not good enough for them, nor their pet. They have to drink bottled water. Only illegal immigrants drink tap water. I actually drink tap water. Once in a while, I drink the plastic water. I hate it. I can't stand the taste of plastic water. Now I found out why I can't stand the taste of plastic water. It's because a study discovered this, that the National Resources Defense Council, which as you well know is a group of crackpots, a group of anti-American crackpots, but the NRDC did a chemical test which doesn't lie. And the crackpots found in testing more than 100 brands of bottled water that 33% of them contain significant contamination. That's bottled water now. Levels of chemical or bacterial contaminants exceeding those allowed under a state or industry standard. You hear this? In at least one test. Now, let's say you like a water called Aquafina, the top-selling bottled water in the U.S. Where does Aquafina come from for you yuppie schmucks? It's taken from municipal tap water in Fresno and Detroit. Okay, that's where it comes from. I guess they charcoal filter it or something. How about you like Santa Lucia or something from Italy, which you pay $10 a bottle for? Parco Naturale delle Fonti di Santa Lucia, right? And you think that it's bottled by monks who are celibate, who wear rubber gloves? Well, yeah, maybe it is. What do you think it costs to transport that water to your little yuppie restaurant in Austin, Texas? What's the carbon footprint on that little bottle of water you're drinking, all you greenies? And what about the recycling? 16% of plastic water bottles, only 16% of plastic water bottles sold in the late great state of California are recycled. You hear? Now, what about that $7 to $10 bottle of water? You don't need it. Los Angeles water, San Francisco water, turns out to be better than bottled water in blind tests. You're not going to believe this, but a test was done, a blind taste test, from people who think that they know something. And they tested water from Paris and from here and from there, blah, 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 blah. And they found out that L.A. drinking water was flawless or nearly flawless, according to the left-wing, anti-American, business-hating Consumer Reports. So the whack job failures at Consumer Reports with big eyeglasses, who went to NYU and failed at everything except writing hate pieces on business, did a test, and they said that L.A. drinking water was flawless. Even they said the tap water was good. You hear this? So I'm reading the paper this morning, the electronic paper. Italy's new dining experience, high security. Rome. Diners are flocking to what could be called the most exclusive restaurant in Italy, one located inside a top security prison where the chefs and waiters are mafiosi, robbers and murderers. Serenaded by Bruno, a pianist doing life for murder, the clientele eat inside a deconsecrated chapel set behind a 60-foot high. Why would they deconsecrate a chapel? Anyway, set behind the 60-foot high walls of the daunting 500-year-old Fortezza Medicea at Volterra near Pisa. Under the watchful eye of armed prison guards, a 20-strong team of chefs, kitchen hands, and waiters nightly serve 120 diners who all have undergone strict security checks. Tables are booked weeks in advance. Prison director Maria Grazia Giampiccolo said the inmates have developed a flair for their cooking. He said, "I feel haute cuisine in a place like this prepares the inmates for when they are eventually released. The guests enjoy their meals, and although the security seems at first very daunting and imposing, they get over it quite quickly and forget about the guards. The mafia may be in charge, but there is no horse's head on this menu. Instead, a smart, mainly middle-aged crowd tucks into a vegetarian signature menu cooked up by head chef Egidio, serving life for murder and competitively priced at $33. The restaurant opened 2 months ago and has proved so popular that Italy's prison department is thinking of trying it in other prisons. I got to laugh for a minute because this can only happen in Italy, where food is life. Now, if you went to a prison in America and you had the criminals in this country cooking, can you imagine what you wind up eating? Jell-O. You'd eat Jell-O and candy bars. That would be their idea of haute cuisine. It's not Italy. Securing a table is as tricky as getting past the sternest maitre d'. Diners are thoroughly vetted by the blah, blah, blah. But there's no danger of the meal being disrupted by the annoying chirrup of cell phones. You hear this? They have to be handed in. Oh, I'd love to eat in this joint. Along with handbags, and I would like to eat here. If only I could go to a restaurant where some idiot moron from hell didn't talk on a phone. Blah, 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 I'm so important. And I'm going to Zurich. Yeah, I just got back from Atlanta. Yeah, I spoke to, blah, 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 blah. I feel like pouring coffee into their cell phone. Why do they let them even talk? It's one of the reasons I don't go to restaurants. I can't listen to people. I'm in a talk business. So when I'm through working, I don't want to listen to chatter. But most people have jobs where they can't talk. So what they do is they have a glass of wine already for $6. Blah, 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 blah. Shoot their mouth. I give them two glasses of wine. They don't shut up. Then you get hit with a bad perfume on top of it all that wafts over and you got a double migraine and there's no point in eating there. Give me this prison. It sounds like a good place to go. Handbags and the diners go through the same thing. in the kitchen, Egidio, a burly 50-year-old from Taranto in Southern Italy, reigns over his team of six chefs. He screams, "The pasta is boiling over. More salt, less garlic. Keep stirring the pasta sauce," he shouts. 17 years into his sentence, he is thinking of going into the restaurant business when they finally let him out. Like any Italian, I take my food very, very seriously. I like to be sure the diners are satisfied. And they don't just enjoy the food, but enjoy it with the same passion that I prepare it. He's in for a murder sentence. He's a prisoner in Italy. Maybe we could elect him to office here. He could form an entire sentence. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given his record, diners have been reluctant to criticize. He said, "Before this, I couldn't even fry an egg. But now here I am preparing five-course dinners, and I have not had any complaints." It could be because they know who he is. "Yo, it's delicious, Edigio. Oh, I love it. Oh, yeah, it's great. Terrific. Yeah, tell him that his food's no good." Most of the dishes the restaurant serves are southern Italian staples from organized crime hotspots like Puglia, Sicily, and Naples. Sommelier Santolo Matroni from Naples landed behind bars after getting into, quote, a spot of bother when he was younger, which earned him a 24-year sentence for murder. He, too, is hoping to use his new skills when he gets out in about 7 years. He says, "I'd like to think that when I get out of here, I can start a family, maybe get a job in a restaurant or hotel. Hey, you should come to America. You know, it's the kind of immigrant we need." The unique nature of the restaurant has imposed some restrictions. Guards watch over the inmates in the kitchens at all times, and the cutlery used as plastic as other plates, said Mr. Giampiccolo. Yeah. "The main thing is trust, and we trust the inmates to behave. If we didn't, we would not allow this to happen." Yeah, well, I'll tell you the subtext in a minute. Diners professed themselves delighted. "When I heard about it, I thought it sounded fun, so we booked a table. And I have to say the food has been very good," said off-duty police officer, blah, blah, blah. "The fact that the dishes are prepared by murderers, armed robbers, mafiosi, or terrorists doesn't really bother me, though I might be worried if someone had been convicted of poisoning." And that's it. Italy's new dining experience, high security. For years, I would go past Alcatraz Island, and I would think to myself, my God, what a great restaurant this would make here instead of a waste. Why don't they just let some restaurant guy open up Alcatraz, and you take a boat to it and eat there? In San Francisco, in fact, they could probably rent out the cells for the night with horses, you know. And then they could be running the movie They Shoot Horses, don't they?
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So today I'm reading a boating magazine in the toilet. I get the boating magazines for the toilet. It's a good place to peruse such heavy reading material. I like to look at the water there, the boats, the mega yachts that I can't afford, you know. But one article caught my eye: the Russian petro billionaires and the kind of boats that they're building. And the world's largest private yacht to be named Eclipse is being built by a man who's in the home of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, which is now the hottest mega yacht market in the world, Russia, where people are still starving, where people are living like serfs. There is a class of billionaire crooks who stole the oil and commodities out of the ground. They're living like czars, and they're outflanking even the Arabs in terms of super yacht purchases. So the biggest one will be built by a guy in Russia. It'll be a 557-foot mega yacht. 557 feet, 170 meters, to be built by Blohm & Voss, a subsidiary of Germany's ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. And that will cast a shadow over the current Lord of the Seas, the 525-foot Dubai, owned by Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, ruler of Dubai. Ha, ha, ha. Dubai. Wonder where they get all their money from in Dubai. So the Russians are now outspending the others. Russia's eighth richest man, Suleiman Kerimkov, had it all, including the 295-foot Lursen boat, ICE, when he crashed his Ferrari in Nice, and now he's in a burn ward. Now, how do they make all of this money? How do they make so much money that they can buy two and three yachts? Some of these guys own three of them. One of them gave away a yacht of about 200 feet to a friend. So who are these oligarchs, these modern czars of Russia? They're young, in their 30s or 40s. They're billionaires overnight. And as much of Russia is floundering in a post-communist collapse, a handful of high-powered crooks with good political connections succeeded in gaining control of the country's vast state-owned industries and natural resources. They literally bought them. And how did they buy them? They didn't have any money. Many of them were college professors. But they were well connected with the government. Follow me here because it's very similar to America. They were connected to the politicians, the corrupt politicians. And they get control of the vast state-owned industries and natural resources. How? Well, this took the form of loans for shares, deals and auctions, which some regard as the greatest scandal of the Boris Yeltsin era. And when Vladimir Putin, the old KGB chief, took over from Yeltsin, Putin was expected to undo the oligarchs' wealth. But what he said to them was, if you stay out of politics, I will not touch you. And so one of these guys bought a company called Sibneft, a company sitting on 30% of Russia's oil. You hear this? One man could buy a company called Sibneft. Remember, Russia was a socialist state. So the oil, the gas, the metals, the gold, the silver was all owned by the government. So now during privatization of the Yeltsin, these crooks come along, and through corrupt politicians and payoffs, they get to buy all of these commodities, these natural resources. So this guy buys for $200 million 30% of Russia's oil, not of his own money, but he borrows the money because of the value of the oil in the ground. So he borrows the money, he buys it. And then in 2005, Gazprom, Russia's state-owned gas company, buys out this 30% of the oil for $13 billion for Sibneft. So the guy borrows $200 million, and he makes $13 billion. You hear this? Then he buys $300 million worth for the $300 million boat, the Eclipse, he's having built. And he also owns the Chelsea England Football Club. He owns a Boeing 767 airplane, a townhouse in Belgravia, central London, a 440-acre estate in Sussex, and a villa in the south of France. He is also the governor of Chukotka and is reportedly trying to buy Silvio Berlusconi's former villa in Sardinia. I read in the article, none of the above information was made available by the secretive mogul. It says he doesn't comment on his personal property. Ranked by Forbes as the world's 16th richest man, worth $18.7 billion, this guy will add Eclipse to a private fleet that already includes three other mega yachts, 377-foot Polaris, 282-foot S. Castilla, and 160-foot Susurro. Once he had four mega yachts, but he gave away the fourth yacht, 370-foot Le Grand Bleu, complete with aquarium, cinema, and helicopter, to a business associate. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because in all nations, there arises a class of pirates. With unlimited greed, they have no nation. They're transnational pirates, in my humble opinion. Seattle, Washington. Ryan, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I wanted to talk about the dogs. That's more interesting than anything else that we're covering.
Yeah, it is. Dogs are interesting. Well, I'm a dog person.
You said that the dogs are allowed anywhere other than where food is served. And I just wanted to let you know, up here in Washington, I'm not sure whether it's a state law or federal law, but you are not allowed to ask a customer whether their dog is for service or not. They can simply say, I need this dog with me. And
In other words, if you ask them if they're a legitimate service dog, you may make one of the fake psychos nervous, and you could affect their condition, and they could sue you, right?
Exactly.
In Washington State, that's where they do animals, right? That's where they did the horses.
Hey, exactly. And I'm serving there one Friday night, and I...
Oh, wait, what if you're working in a restaurant and a man comes in with a horse in Seattle? Can you come to any conclusion with that? What if he says, this is my service animal?
Well, I don't think we're far off the way things are going.
Yeah, you have a great governor, a terrific governor in the state of Washington. Great, great mayor in the state of Seattle, in the city of Seattle. Terrific place. So what, you're a waiter up there? What happened?
Hey, the first weekend that happened, I'm wondering, what in the world is going on? A dog's in here. You know, I'm allergic to cats. Somebody could be allergic to dogs.
Oh, my God. A cat in a restaurant, I never go back. I'm allergic to cats. I hate them.
Next weekend, I swear.
I hate cats. My throat closes up.
The customer saw that dog in there. The next weekend, three dogs are in there at the same time. And I'm sitting here wondering if
now, what happens if a dog takes a dump under a table? Tell me, you have to clean it up?
Hey, we got to clean up the puke in the bathroom, right?
Oh, my God. Do they make waiters clean up the bathrooms?
Yep.
Oh, that's no, no, no. Ryan, I think that that's a violation of your rights as an employee. I don't believe a waiter should have to clean up a vomit in a bathroom.
We'll put up with it till we move on to something better, right?
Yeah, let's get off this topic. This is getting crazy. But, no, I see where you're coming from. But in Seattle, if a man comes in with a horse, you don't know what they're doing together. He could say it's a service animal.
Well, and...
what if he says it's his partner?
You know, I don't know that the law doesn't cover that. We might not be
able to... Oh, yeah, well, the law... You know, Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century English essayist, said the law is an ass. He pretty much knew what the law was. You know who writes the law, don't you? You know who writes the law. That it brings up a very good point. No, this dog and restaurant thing is out of control. Only I should be able to bring my dog to a restaurant because he's self-controlled. He does not pee in a restaurant. He doesn't even bark. But I could see why it's a problem. Thanks for the call.
There are other topics out there. 1-800-449-8255. I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
I almost feel like now moving away completely from the politics of the day and almost going into the bars I drank in. The people I ran into, how I feel a little hungover. I always do very good shows when I have a slight hangover. Not a very severe hangover, but a mild hangover is very, very good for radio, I find. And I've always found it to be very good for radio. I don't know what it is. Let's see, what did I do? So as the curtain of night descended upon the Savage Nation's host, yours truly, Michael Savage, I wandered up to the district known as North Beach in San Francisco, the... more or less still Italian district of the city. Actually, I didn't go directly there. I walked up California. I have a certain walk I like, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to be, let us say, accosted on the way. But I walked through Chinatown on the way to North Beach because I love Chinatown. The reason I love to walk down Grant Avenue at night is because it gives me hope to see the small merchants closing their stores at night, raising their gates, securing their wares. It reminds me of my father's little store down in New York on Ludlow Street, how they would close the gates at night and lock it up and look with a love at the merchandise that fed their family. Now, you don't see much of this anymore in America. Most of us are so removed from merchandise and being a shopkeeper. But in essence, the small businessman, the small businesswoman, is the core of the capitalist system and always has been and probably always will be. Despite the dominance of the great corporations, the small businessman is the key to the survival of a capitalist nation. Anyway, to make a long story short, I also like to see the Chinese people. I like hearing, as I walk down the avenue, the young men, the vigorous young men practicing martial arts in the upstairs studios, either through the drums. The drums are also part of the martial arts. I hear them practicing Taekwondo in some of the studios. I mean, I hear everything. I'm like Vincent the Blind Man, if you want to know the truth, because as I walk, although my eyes are open, so are my ears, and I have very sharp ears, and I listen to the sounds of the street. I don't have to know one word of Mandarin to understand what's going on. And I say to myself, you know, this gives me hope. And the reason it gives me hope is because I know that the Islamofascists will never conquer the Chinese, not in China nor in America. I said, are you kidding me? You're telling me these Tongs are going to let the Islamofascists dominate their neighborhood? Never in a million years. They disappear without you even knowing what happened. And there are so many other ethnic enclaves in this country that will never fall under the sway of the sword. That's all I can tell you. They have faced the conqueror in the past, and they have driven the conqueror out. Of course, there are, if you want to get into the history of China and its conquest, and it was conquered by the Muslims at a certain point, but I won't go into that because you don't know that half of China is Muslim and a good half of China was Muslim as a result of conquest. But in the United States of America, I can tell you right now, they don't even know this is going on. These people live in their own world, and it's kind of nice to step into a world that is separated from my world. So I walked through the Chinatown, as I said, smelling the garbage in the street, and walked across Broadway, where you step across Broadway, now you're suddenly stepping into the garlic world, the world of garlic and jazz, so to speak, and you're into the
Italian district. And for some reason, I went to a place that I haven't been for years. I used to hang out there a lot. It's an Irish bar. And I looked for my friend because I hadn't seen him in years. I stopped hanging out up there a number of years ago. And I went into O'Reilly's Tavern, and there was Miles, an old friend of mine running an Irish tavern. And we talked. I said, how's your son? He's 10 years old. And I haven't seen him in 5 years or more. I remember when he was a little boy in the bar. And I said, you know, I still remember your English, your Irish, what was he, an Irish, what do they call those, giant dogs? Help me out, I forget. And you know those big dogs, whatever they're called, the Irish something or other. No, not an Irish setter. They're gigantic. They're hounds. They're giant. He had a dog, Fionn. They only lived to six. I love this dog. I watched him grow up in the bar. This dog was so big that he, like a foot was as bigger than my dog Teddy's entire body. And one of the most beautiful dogs in the world. But he died at six. I said, you know, Miles, I remember your first dog, Fionn. He says, oh, I had a second. And he died too. He says, now I have a third, just a wee puppy. He's still got the Irish whatever. I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the dog. I'm feeling kind of silly right now. I can't. But, you know, it was nice going in there. But on the way in, two guys offered to buy me a drink, and I never accept a drink from a stranger. I'm just that kind of girl. So I didn't accept the drink from the strangers, but we got to talk. It turns out that they're sheriff's deputies from another county in California who just happened to hear my voice and say, I can't believe our luck, and we talked. Whatever topic is on your mind will be fair game. Consumer culture. I was never into that. I try to buy something this week. I don't know what's wrong with me. I have trouble buying things. I wear the same clothing for years. I'm comfortable in it. I know it doesn't look as good. So I went out. I forced myself to buy four pair of pants the other day. And I came home. I looked at them. And I proceeded to hang them up and put them in the back of the closet. I'm saving them for an important day. I don't know what that day may be, but I'm saving them. Then I buy a new pair of sneakers. That took an hour. I almost died till he found the right size. This size, take that size and the width, a D, an E, a double. I didn't have the old ones. Finally, I bought a pair. I said, oh, fine. Just give them to me, please. You're very nice. Put them in a bag. Then I got a yen to buy a pair of shoes. Like an idiot, I bought something that looked good. They looked like an elf shoe. I went back to like the 60s. There was like an elf shoe. Like, I knew better. Oh, that looks good. I'll wear them around the house. I was crippled from them. I put them on for 5 minutes. I couldn't walk. So I had to return them. I had to have them returned today. And it was a strange thing. Did I tell you what the dog did while the guy was trying to shoe on my foot? The first time I put my foot down on that little stand they have for the shoe, Teddy was with me. He didn't do anything. Then the next time the guy said, try the other foot on it. I put the other foot down. Teddy jumped between the foot and the guy's hands. So I try to think, what in the world does a dog perceive? What was he perceiving? So I thought maybe, trying to project my Darwinian mind to the dog, he probably thought the guy was taking my foot by putting it into with an instrument. What does he know? He's a stranger with a thing in his hand, taking his master's foot into an object called a shoe, and then like sealing it up with a lace. So he figured that was no good. It was dangerous. Then there was a miserable woman there with two dogs that gives dog owners a bad name in department stores. You know, it's a privilege to let you bring a dog in a department store, and I'm really glad they do. Because guys like me are good owners. This piece of garbage, she was from New York living in Marin. I knew the type. I saw right away where she was. So she has two rat dogs with her, one like a Maltese yapper. My dog doesn't bark. They start barking at my dog. No, here's what starts. I'm getting my shoes on, and Teddy's minding his business. And she looks over from like 25 yards away. I don't know where. They have eagle eyes, these shopaholics. And she looks over and she says something like out loud, like she knows me. What kind of dog is that? So I'm like, what kind of dog is that? So I said, take a guess. She wants to play Brooklyn with me. I can answer in Brooklyn. What kind of dog is that? Like she's familiar already. She said, why don't you take a guess? So she says, a poodle? So I say nothing. All right, so she don't say anything, but I see she's seething already that no one answered, that I didn't answer her. A few minutes later, she walks by and right away, the dogs start barking, her dogs. You know what she has the nerve to say out loud? Oh, honey, you don't like that dog, do you? Meaning her dog didn't like my dog. Now, I could have gotten mad, but I control myself. And I say, this is why I don't buy anything. It's why I don't go out of the house. It's why I become a recluse and do takeout. I can't take it. People are mean everywhere, wherever you go. I mean, the clerks are nice in these stores. They're very nice guys. I don't know how they put up with people. Then I always get sad in that department store because they have a piano player. It breaks my heart to hear I see a grown man sitting at a piano in the middle of the day, and I have the kind of kaleidoscopic mind. I know that this kid, it was like, let's say he was a C-talent musician, but he's like 45, good-looking guy in a tuxedo, playing in a department store. So all I don't see that. I see sadness coming my way. Why? I see all the way back to the first grade, kindergarten, preschool. Oh, look at that. Billy's talented. Let's take lessons. And the mother and father kill themselves. They pay for the lessons. And they encourage him to go to the high school of performing farts and blah, blah, blah. And the kid becomes an artiste and he struggles his whole life. And he's living on next to nothing. And here he is, 45, playing a piano in a department store. I'm not putting the guy down. But I hear the music and I get depressed. I don't want to hear the music there. I don't want to hear a piano in a department store. Because I don't just see the guy. I see like a whole tragedy there. Well, what are you going to do? I guess they pay him something. I have no idea. So I'm not a shopaholic is what I'm saying. I sat up there on a hill looking at the bay and looking at, I fed some fish. I have a place on in a hidden place with a fish pond. It's funny, you know, the fish have babies. They haven't given up the desire to reproduce. It's funny. I guess they haven't read the New York Times. They don't realize how primitive they are. The boy fish and the girl fish still do it. And there's minnows. There's big fish and then there's minnows. I guess they haven't read the San Francisco Chronicle, realizing how gauche they are. Laying eggs. Ugh. Viviparous reproduction. Yuck. Yuck. Eggs. Ugh. Yeah, that's not cute. You know, the woman fish gets...
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I want to change pace on the show to something that is so horrible. It's about the mother and the two daughters who were raped repeatedly and set on fire and killed and slaughtered in their flame-engulfed home several years ago in New Haven, Connecticut, by two fiends. I want to talk about the father who survived. I want to talk about the police who I believe should be put in prison for their inaction in Connecticut. You heard me, didn't you? You ever hear me attack police? You know, just as there is malpractice amongst surgeons or doctors, and some surgeons have lost their livelihood because of mistakes with the scalpel or such, I believe that police should be held culpable in cases where they either do something wrong or they don't act properly. And I believe they should lose their jobs and lose their pensions. In some cases, they should go to jail. This is one of the most horrendous crimes I've ever read about in my entire life. And it's about a Connecticut home invasion in which Dr. William Pettit's wife and two young girls were raped repeatedly after being strapped to beds. One daughter was 11 years old. Her name was Michaela, 11 years old. His other daughter's name, Haley, age 17. The two fiends, I will tell you the whole story because you have to hear this. You got to hear the whole story because I'm not going to let you go until you hear the whole story. Because the police were summoned to the house while the women were still alive. How? Well, the fiends made the woman go to the bank and withdraw $15,000. The woman can be seen on videotape telling the bank teller her family was being held hostage. So the bank teller did her job. She calls the police. Did you hear this? And guess what the police did? Guess what the police did as the girls were being raped and the house was being doused with gasoline? You know what the police did? They set up a perimeter around the house and sat there waiting for the flames to emerge. And they did nothing. They didn't call the fire department. They didn't call an ambulance. The police did nothing but sit there
in terror and fear. Now, you could blame the police if you want, call them cowards, and you'd be right. You could blame the police and say, well, what do you want from them? They're afraid of being sued, and you'd be right. You could lay all the blame on the ACLU for what they've done to the police in this country, and you'd be right. But you know what? It doesn't matter, because 50 years ago, the cops would have broke the doors down. They would have, some of them would have broken through the windows with nightsticks, and they would have found the fiends, and they would have beat them to death with nightsticks or shot them. And they would have pulled the women out of a burning house. Raped and broken as they were, they would be alive. The cops of yesterday are not the cops of today. Many of this new generation of cops are college-educated punks that are no better than half of the criminals. You never heard me say it? Well, I'll say it again until you get to understand what went on here in Connecticut. Dad relives massacre hell. I got it from the New York Post. And you won't believe what the police did when they could have saved them. Now, I believe the ACLU lawyers should be tried as accomplices, accessories to these murders. It'll never happen with the vermin who run this country. But the police were summoned after the wife told the bank teller her family was being held hostage. Did you hear this? Cops arrived, and they set up a perimeter. Maybe they had some coffee delivered. They hid behind their patrol cars, guns drawn, and they sat waiting. Shocking testimony reveals police inaction in Connecticut, horror home invasion. The revelations come on a day three of testimony in the murder trial of crack addict Steve Hayes, charged as one of the two monsters who launched a reign of rape and murder against the Cheshire, Connecticut family on Monday morning in July of 07. The entire chronology can be seen linked up from the post on michaelsavage.com. So the bank employee calls the police. One of the captains tells the units not to approach the house. No fire, no ambulance, no state police or other emergency authorities have yet been contacted. Minutes later, 20 minutes later, another one of the captains, Robert Vignola, puts out a radio transmission indicating the perimeter is still being set up. Now, remember, the girls are now strapped to a bed. They've been raped all day, and the fiends are spreading gasoline around the house. Police Captain Robert Vignola is outside, and he goes on the radio, and he says, "We're still setting up the perimeter. No one is to even call the house until that perimeter is ready." Police radio dispatch 10 minutes later indicates that someone, in this case, it's Dr. Pettit, the victim father who was beaten and left for dead, was calling out for help in the invaded home's backyard. Dr. Pettit, who would be the sole survivor of this home invasion, had broken free from the basement and bleeding profusely from blows to the head by the fiends, and with his ankle still bound, was rolling his body across 2 yards, begging for help. It was at this moment that Hayes and his co-defendant, Joshua Komisarevsky, ran out of the Pettit home and peeled out down the driveway, driving Hawk Pettit's SUV. Inside, fire began to sweep through the house, setting on fire the two girls and the mom. But even at this point, a half hour after police were notified of the incident, 30 minutes later, no fire, no ambulance, no state police or other emergency authorities had been alerted, according to this morning's testimony. It was only after the stolen SUV crashed into a police cruiser a block away, and smoke began to rise from the rear of the home, did the genius Captain Vignola call the fire department. So who's responsible for this? Well, of course, the two vermin who did this to the girls and the mother. But wait, they have defense counsel now for 2 or 3 years defending them. Where did they get the money to defend them? Who was paying for this defense? Everything about this case in Connecticut is an indicator of everything that has gone wrong in this country. The police are inactive. The criminals are treated with better respect and better lawyers than the victims. The ACLU has destroyed every aspect of American society, and we the people sit here like victims of these vermin in the ACLU and the legal profession. Here we have lawyers taking their brilliant little minds, the product of the worst law schools in the history of the universe, defending these men who we know did it. Oh, even their defense counsel admits they did it. But how clever lawyers can be. The father was beaten beyond recognition, and they thought that he was going to die anyway. He had fallen asleep on the sunroom couch the night before following a pasta dinner made by his wife and his 11-year-old daughter. He fell asleep, and he woke up feeling pain and blood running down his face. Two people standing in front of him. He saw a gun in one of their hands. He said he understood what was going on. But somehow they didn't kill him. They thought he was going to die anyway, and one of them said, if he wakes up, put two bullets in him. Two men untied his ankles and marched him down to the basement where his ankles were retied and he was bound at the chest and waist to a support pole. He was bleeding profusely. And then he heard something, one of his daughters saying upstairs, that woke him awake as he was near death. It's something, he said, that woke him up from the dead. A voice, one of the intruders, one of the vermin, one of the maniacs, said to one of his daughters, don't worry. It will soon be over. Don't worry, it's going to be over in a couple of minutes. He got free, and he somehow got into the backyard. He was so beaten up, he had to roll on the grass, and he was calling out for help, and the police were drinking coffee in their perimeter. They're having a nice coffee, waiting to see what to do next. Police, after all, have been summoned after the wife told the bank teller her family was being held hostage. They arrived right after that. They surrounded the house. And they did nothing. Nothing. And they find the father in the neighbor's driveway, the beaten up, bleeding father. They find him there, and a cop says to him, well, who's in the house there? The father says, the girls are in the house. Cut this stuff off my feet. The cops wouldn't do it. The officer said, stay down, you're a witness. The father says to them, the girls are in the house. Cop says, stay down, you're a witness. Soon after, the home goes up in flames. When Hayes, a 47-year-old crack addict and burglar, sets the house on fire. You know where the bastards met each other? You want to hear another little piece of the story? One of them, named Komisarevsky, I think he's a Russian emigre, age 29, met the other one, Hayes, in a prison halfway house. And they were two burglars together. They met in a halfway house put there by liberals who said that prisons are too tough, prisons are too mean, it dehumanizes people. They sue prisons because the medical care isn't good enough. And they tell you that you should put people like this in halfway houses where they can learn how to rape and kill from each other, you see. So they meet in a halfway house. And how did they come to pick on this poor woman? Pure random. Pure random. They were out one night, and they saw the mother and the daughters getting into a Chrysler. And one of them said, I like that car, let's trail them. They didn't rape them. They didn't break in that night, by the way. They were skilled burglars. They were skilled break-in artists. They waited for nightfall. And at night, they broke in through a window going into the basement. And that's how it all started. Now, look, I could say to you 100 different things. Every home should have multiple guns, even for children over 16. Every child over 16 should be taught how to use a pistol. That's number one. There should be gun lessons in high schools. Throw the Ritalin in the garbage. Throw the Prozac in the garbage. Throw the school psychologist into a mental hospital and teach the children how to use a gun. That's number one. I went to school in Jamaica High School when I was a kid. I was on the rifle team. So there were guns. No one killed each other. Now, I realize I have gone from the specific of a horrendous home invasion in Connecticut to the more general question of how America has been hobbled and crippled by the vermin on the left from the top to the bottom who have penetrated every aspect of American society, from the lowest to the highest levels. Remember the movie Fahrenheit 451? I can give you five different movies. You're living in it. My friends, you were living in every horror movie of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Every horror book ever written, whether it was Orwell or Huxley, every prediction of the nightmare that was coming, you're living in. When the enemy itself is in this country and dictating to you what you should do to protect yourself from your enemy. That's right. And the very defense cells who should be protecting you from them have been brainwashed by the enemy into telling you that they're the victim and you're the racist.
Savage.
Play Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. I see John Travolta with Bell Bottom.
doing disco in the aisles of a 747 with his friends from Scientology, meeting their God as they fly across the Earth's atmosphere, discoing into the next universe. I think I had one pair of bell bottoms. They made you feel so free, didn't they? Didn't they give you a sense of freedom? Those velvet bell bottoms. I don't know. I wish I could say what I really meant on this show. What needs to be done. Wish I could really let it out. One day, just open up the 12 cylinders inside my soul. Right now I'm running on about 6, 7. If I could really pour gas down those cylinders, I could give you an action plan that would have you alerted, alive. You'd feel alive you haven't felt, like you haven't felt in 30 years. I could bring this country to a halt. I could change things in 2 days. But instead, I will just play disco music. Play it a little louder, please. Louder, louder. Picture all of the truckers. Picture every independent trucker in America blocking every tunnel and every bridge in America to say enough is enough to the Congress and the oil companies. Just envision that. You want to have a vision? Let's start with the basics. One day, one strike like in France, where every independent trucker closes down every bridge and every tunnel in the United States of America. You want to see those liars and rats in Congress finally do something instead of pointing fingers at each other? You want to see the Seven Sister Oil Companies go to prison? Pay, play, 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 staying alive. Go ahead, play, staying alive. Play, staying alive. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm not recommending this, of course. That's plan of action number one for today in the fantasy land of the Savage Nation. But we're just doing disco. Disco on the Savage Nation. Staying alive. Staying alive. But I have a dream. I have a dream that one day I'll awaken to every bridge and tunnel in America blocked by the independent truckers of America who say, up yours, Johnson. Up yours, Jack. You've jacked us up. You've killed us. You brought in drivers from Mexico. You've undermined us and killed us. Up yours, Jack. All you corporate CEOs, here's the middle finger from the truck driver. How's that for step one to take back America on the Savage Nation? Staying alive, staying alive. Staying alive, staying alive. Step number one, fantasy in the Savage Nation. A fantasy in the Savage Nation. We become France. France becomes us. The workers go on strike. The real workers, not the illegal alien workers. Strike for illegal things. No, the legitimate American truck driver. He blocks every bridge and every tunnel and every artery in America stops. The country comes to a halt. No food, no garbage, no fuel, nothing in, nothing out. Suddenly the CEO crooks, the pirates in business suits. They can't do the two-step. Suddenly the thieves and criminals in Congress who point fingers to deceive us can no longer do the two-step. I'll be right back. Keep on dreaming, Mike. Fact is, it's a talk show. I've been around for 16 years, and with God's willing, I'll be around a little longer, whatever. This is the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Now we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. Raleigh, North Carolina. Tiffany, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Savage. Just calling to let you know that I really enjoy listening to your show.
That's all? That's the whole thing?
No, that's not the whole thing.
Give me the whole thing. Give me the whole shot.
I enjoy listening to your show. I happen to learn a lot when I'm listening to your show.
And oh, that's nice. I do. I try to bring a little more then I have to, you know, because otherwise people would find it boring unless you give them a little poetry, a little learning, a little sign. Yeah, I bet you go away feeling you learned a little, like you were a little bit in school, but in a fun way.
Yeah, in a fun and crazy kind of way. I wish you wouldn't get so upset, though, because I declare I have to turn because I'm thinking you're going to fall out on the radio.
No, I worry about it myself, too, Tiffany. Sometimes I say, you know, at night I can't sleep. I get so worked up over these issues like immigration and diseases, I go crazy. And then I get agitated to the point where I worry myself. I say, what are you, nuts? You're going to wind up dying here. The last thing that... Your fear, Tiffany, is that one day I'm going to be screaming and yelling, and this is the last thing you're going to hear. And I'll tell you! That's your fear, is the mic goes over and I'm finished. Peter on WRKO, you're on the Savage Nation.
Franklin Roosevelt saved England and basically Europe, not Churchill.
Okay. So what is it you're arguing about FDR? What part of this argument am I missing?
Well, you're missing the fact that you tout Churchill as the great leader that in certain instances was, but he could stand there and make the speech that we will fight on the beaches and so on and so forth. But if FDR did not...
All right, well, let's take one person at a time. Churchill was the spiritual or intellectual leader of the English people. He tried to warn them through the 1930s. They wouldn't listen to him. During the war, they did listen to him, and he gave them the courage to fight. Admittedly, it was the Lend-Lease deal and the American troops who saved England. But are you arguing, therefore, that because FDR was a liberal, that we need that only a liberal can save America?
Excuse me, FDR was a progressive Democrat, and if you are a...
All right, wait, he was a progressive Democrat. So are you arguing that the internment of the Japanese by this progressive Democrat was a liberal policy that you would support?
I'm not discussing Japan. I'm discussing the fact that...
Sir, you just said that FDR was a progressive Democrat and that he saved the West during World War II. So I'm asking you, which of the progressive Democrats' policies is it that you are offering us as an example today? Is it the internment of the Japanese?
Nope. I'm talking about the fact of the Second World War and beginning before the Second World War.
Sir, wait a minute. You cannot separate and take away individual acts of FDR and say that those were exceptions. Didn't he pass an executive order to intern the Japanese?
Absolutely. But if you
all right, so wait, no, wait. Does that make him a progressive Democrat, or does that tell us that in times of war, the progressive politics that you seem to be a fan of may have to be put on hold?
Again, I'm not going to discuss that. If you want to end the call, fine. I want to talk about...
What do you mean you won't discuss it? Is that because you can't or you won't?
No, I won't. How's that?
Well, why not? Tell me why you will not discuss the internment of the Japanese, since you're glorifying FDR and you're saying it's his liberalism that saved the West. But I'm asking you if his acts during World War II, of which there were many, including the internment of the Japanese, were liberal acts or were they actually conservative acts?
They were acts at the time... that probably were warranted, but hindsight, Monday morning quarterback, showed that they would not have been done if people were not concerned with a so-called imminent attack by the Japanese on our West Coast. Okay?
Wait a minute. I'm missing the point. So let's look at some of the... You don't want to talk about the internment of the Japanese by this progressive Democrat. So let's talk about some of the other acts of FDR during World War II that certainly don't exhibit any kind of progressive liberal nature. They were very clearly conservative in nature. Many of his acts were conservative in nature. So during the war, he was able to put aside his socialism and his tendencies toward liberalism and move to save America. So I don't see where you and I have to argue over this.
Yeah, we do have to argue over it because of the fact that the way you tout Churchill with regard to basically saving England is a lot of horse feathers because it took...
So you're arguing now that Churchill's work in the 1930s was to no avail? He single-handedly built up the British armaments industry. What are you talking about?
Look, if it wasn't...
He was fought by men like you who were appeasers who said... Germany does not threaten us. We don't need to build up our Navy. We don't need to build up our Air Force. It was because of Churchill that they built the Spitfire plane during the 1930s. It was because of Churchill that they built up the Royal Navy, that they had a military. So how can you argue he had no effect upon the war?
And in our country, we had so-called conservative Republicans that said, this fight is not ours. Europe's war is not ours. You don't remember that, but if you read history, you would have seen that.
Well, don't lecture me about history because you read one book. Your points do not make sense. What you're trying to argue is that we need a progressive leader to save us in this battle against Islamofascism. But I'm willing to bet that you won't even identify Islamofascism as the threat, will you? But what happened to you? You went deaf, dumb, and blind all of a sudden? Where do you stand on the threat from Osama bin Laden and the Islamofascists? Do you say it doesn't exist, it does exist, or what?
No, I don't want to even get into that.
What do you want to get into? Why are you wasting my time? Go back to one of your communist halls down there in Boston and give yourself the malarkey and then have a scotch on me. You're living in the past, my friend. You're an old trade unionist who doesn't even know what the hell you're talking about anymore.
Conflict of interest in discussing all of this, too.
You don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're talking about. If you're unwilling or unable to understand the threat we're facing from the Muslim invasion and the Muslim crusade that is going on around the world, how can we even have a discussion?
No, I understand what the threat is.
So what do we argue with? Then why are you and I two good Americans fighting? Why are we fighting with each other?
Threat is, okay. I understand what the threat is, but I'm
so
not...
then why are you and I? Where are we disagreeing? I don't even understand what the disagreement is.
My disagreement is with your, you're touting Churchill at every time I listen to you, and I do listen to you because it's entertainment. Not fact, but entertainment.
That's right. In other words, you liberals are the only ones who have brains. We have no brains, the conservatives. We entertain you. The reason you're listening to me is that inside you, there's a man who can still live and stand up and understand reality. The man who wants to overcome and break free of the shackles of liberalism. That's why you're listening to me. I'm not entertaining you. I'm educating you, Peter.
No, not me. If you look at the people that have taken us through wars from the First World War through the Second World War, through Korea, through Vietnam, were all Democrat presidents. They
weren't. So what are you saying, that the Democrats are the party of war?
Fanatical, radical...
Wait a minute. Are you saying that the Democrats are the party of militancy and war?
No, I'm saying that the Democrats...
Oh, wait, you just said that. I agree with you. It has been Democrats who've taken us to war. Absolutely, I agree with you. So what's your point? That they're a militant party of war? Well, then I would gladly become a Democrat if they were still a party willing to stand up for America, but they're not. They become a sort of European socialist party of appeasers. They're not that party that you're talking about. I would gladly join a party that was still a JFK, FDR-type party. They disappeared a long time ago, Peter. I think you're living in another world.
No, they didn't disappear. They're there. They are there.
What about my statement that in 1933, did you hear that piece or you missed that?
Which one? Churchill?
The year that the Nazis came to power, the Oxford Union, which is a debating society where all of the future British political elite would debate, they passed a resolution that said this house would under no circumstances fight for its king and country. That you and I would agree, I think, that that's appeasement, wouldn't you?
You got to remember your history. The Germans and
the English. Sir, wait, don't speak down to me. Don't talk down to me because I'll throw you off my show. This is my bar, not yours. You got to remember your history, and you got to remember that I'm far more educated than you are.
Well, yeah, that's why they didn't accept you into Berkeley. You remember how much you were?
Excuse me, sir. Hello, I earned my PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. What are you talking about? Just what are you talking about?
I never applied
for anything but admission to the PhD program, and I got my PhD in 3 years, sir, with a 3.94. A GPA, whatever they call it, out of a 4.0. Can you match those credentials, sir?
What about the time you applied for...
Well, no. You see, again, you're a classic weasel. Every time you lose a point, you change the argument. You can't win one point with me, so you keep going to the next point. But I got news for you. You're fighting a futile battle.
You're absolutely
1933,
right.
The Nazis come to power. The Oxford Union, a liberal debating society, says... We, this house, would under no circumstances fight for its king and country. That is appeasement. You know that, and I know that. How did Hitler take it? He said, well, the British would never fight another war with Germany. He became emboldened. It's identical to what your leader, Nancy Pelosi, is doing with the Islamofascists. I'm ashamed at you, sir, because you probably were one day, at one time in your life, an educated, intelligent man.
Savage.
Now he's a true childhood story, Barry Schmaltz and his crazy mother Betty Schmaltz and his father Louis Schmaltz. The names have been changed to protect the Schmaltzes. Let's see, how do I begin the story? He was about 15 years old. He was a tall kid. His bedroom, pink carpet, two-story house, nice house. He's having a fist fight with his father in the bedroom over something his mother said. It ends with him crying and enraged because he knew he could beat the heck out of his father after a few real good punches were thrown. I don't know if you ever seen a father and son fight. It's actually heartbreaking to see. To me, it was a violation of a very deeply held taboo. Never to strike your father no matter what. Well, I don't know, but that family was crazy from top to bottom. They went at each other with straight rights and blasted each other. And it ended with the kid holding his punches because I think he couldn't really knock his father on his butt. He picked up a piggy bank that to me was like, looked like a 25-pound piggy bank that he had, a ceramic one, since I knew him for 10 years. And he was enraged and red-faced and tears running down his eyes. He looked at his father, and he smashed the piggy bank on the floor, and all the coins that he had collected since childhood was smashed. And then the father threw him out of the house, and he wound up living in my mother's in our basement for a little while. Now, I don't know this guy anymore, but let me tell you what happened that day. Here's what happened that day. His mother was a would-be, like, movie star, as many women were in the 50s. They were always trying to be like either not Marilyn Monroe, but there were some buxom movie like Jane Mansfield, more like that type. Cadillac, the platinum blonde hair, always showing off. The father was a worker, gray-faced. He'd come home gray-faced from his job. He owned a little wholesale milk business. So they were a little better off than us somehow. But she had the Cadillac, the Coupe de Ville, pink one. And a whack job, nuts, out of her mind. Why? She was always trying to lose weight. She went to some doctor in New Jersey who put her on Benzedrine or some kind of amphetamines, which gave her a madness, a Benny high. And so she comes home crazy out of her mind, and she takes a dog chain, and a dog chain, and beats her wrist till it bleeds just before the father comes in at dusk, ashen-faced from the day in the milk plant, and she says, Louie, look what your rotten son did to me. Look what he did to my hands. Well, Louie, the father, naturally would be protective of his wife. He runs upstairs and screams to the kid, Barry, what did you do to your mother? And the kid says, I didn't do anything. You liar, you. And that's when they fought. And that's when it happened. That's when the piggy bank. So from the crazy mother, Betty Schmaltz, who turned Louis against Barry. Now, you say drug usage is prevalent today. Let me tell you something. There's plenty of drug usage in those glorious Eisenhower days, but it was sub rosa drug usage. Half the women were either on Miltown or on Benzedrine for diet. Miltown was as popularly prescribed then as Prozac, let's say, is today. You know, a lot of kids came home from college and used a little Miltown with rosé wine, Meduse rosé. They got a nice buzzeroo during the afternoons when the mother wasn't home. So I'm telling you, that's the Schmaltz story. It's a sad story. And the kid wound up basically a bug all his life. He was never stable. Well, I haven't seen him in many years. But he was a good friend of mine, but he's not a reliable friend when a kid can't rely upon his mother or his father, he winds up to be an unreliable person in life 99% of the time. He winds up to be someone you can't count on because he can never count on somebody else. Right after the show, I'm racing over to the Yacht Harbor to go out on my boat. So during the break, I called and I ordered two pizzas. I have a friend who's going to bring the pizza to the boat. So I said, "So she bothered me. She said to me, what kind of pizza? I said, I'm on a break. I don't know anything. I said, I know sausage and pepper and onion. I said, no, I can't. I said, Teddy's kosher. I said, he can't have sausage. It was funny. She laughed. I said, he's Hillel, not Halal. That's a joke unto itself, but it's like for a very, very small number of people. From Hillel to Halal in one generation. You know what I find amazing is that Halal food is actually kosher food. This is the good news, is that moderate Muslims actually eat Jewish food. Thank God. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same kosher food laws. There's got to be some way to build on that. If a Muslim who's not fanatic can eat a kosher food that the rabbi certifies the chicken, you know, was circumcised or whatever it is, that the cow didn't go to a bathhouse, the normal cow had a husband, had a baby, then got slaughtered, boom, and he'll eat it. And they could both eat the same cow and the same chicken and then the milk and the meat and the flesh and the poultry and no winged creatures and no hoof creatures and no flying creatures with big eyes and no feelers if they go out in the right way, the wrong way, the feeler is this, then you can't eat it. It's the same rules. It comes from the Old Testament. There's got to be a way to build understanding here between Jews and Muslims. You start with the halal and kosher thing. Maybe there's a way to save the world here. You can't eat a crawling creature that crawls backwards on its belly, but you can eat a crawling creature that flies on Mondays between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern time. God. You ever read those rules? They're very complicated. Most of us can't even live up to the Big Ten. Just thou shalt not steal. Forget about it. You're already looking for a clause. Well, I don't steal, but sometimes I have to take. That's not stealing. It's like Paris Hilton. It's L.A. I do not steal, but I hear you on that. But I took something that wasn't mine, but it wasn't really theirs either. And because I'm in L.A., I hear you when I was caught and released in 3 days. Take another rule on the Big Ten. It's impossible for me to follow. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, I don't commit adultery because the person I did it with wasn't married. I may be married, but they weren't. So technically, if you look at it from a biblical point of view, that's not adultery. That's just having a good time, and the girl was single, and she knew I was married, and she wanted the money, so who's it bothering? Nobody. Wasn't adultery. All right. Everything is a clause and an out and a twist. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass, his house, his mouse, his clock. The mouse ran up the clock. I don't covet. I only want it. How does it differ with the want from covet? I don't exactly know, but I know that covetousness is horrible. It is biblically detestable. So I never covet. I only want that which I take. So what I'm saying is we can't even live up to the Big Ten most of the time. Lie, cheat, steal. But now you take religious Jews and religious Muslims. They got like 300, or the religious Jews have 333 commandments. No wonder they're praying all day long. They're praying for forgiveness. Because all day long they're breaking a commandment. They got to be. They didn't touch the fringe properly. The fringe was blue and white, but not exactly the right blue. They prayed forward instead of backwards. The head moved. It's so complicated. And that's why you have to pray all day long if you have 333 rules, because no doubt you're breaking the rules somewhere. Even when you're sleeping, you broke a rule. The first thing you do when you wake up is say, God, forgive me for breaking a rule in the middle of the night. I touched myself below the belt. I didn't mean to. But I was asleep. It was unconscious. It was subconscious. It wasn't me. It was Harry did it. I didn't really do it. There's an evil spirit in me named Harry. Harry reached down below the belt. I didn't mean to. He did. You should punish him. Don't punish me. But since we're in the same body, I understand you, God. I forgive you. God says, you don't have to forgive me, man. I'm the big guy. I'm in charge. Well, I forgive you anyway. Don't say it again, because then you're really going to get punished.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Really important piece to play for you now. My incredible staff, Beowulf and Phil and Doug, during the break, they went and got the 911 call of the bank teller who called the police right after Mrs. Pettit came in and said that this was going on in her house. Listen to this.
Special emergency.
My name is Mary Lyons. I'm the banking center manager at Bank of America at 185 Highland Avenue.
Okay.
There is no robbery here, but we have a lady who is in our bank right now who says that her husband and children are being held at their house. The people are in a car outside the bank. She is getting $15,000 to bring out to them that if the police are told, they will kill the children and the husband. Her name is Jennifer Pettit, P-E-T-I-T. They have their faces covered. She is petrified. She wasn't going to call the police, but I came in my office and I did.
Okay, she still is in the bank?
Yes, she is.
Okay, her husband and family.
And two, and I looked, yes, they're tied up. She said she's taking $15,000 out of a credit line. They told her they wouldn't hurt anybody if she got back there with the money. She believes them. I think she's walking out now. She's walking out now.
Now, listen to this. The police did nothing. The 911 schmuck didn't even believe her. Police said there were no signs of violence at the home, so they set up a perimeter, and there was confusion. Captain of the police says the teller was not even fully convinced that the hostage situation was true. I didn't hear that in the tellers. The teller should be given a prize. The teller did her job. And if we lived in a normal, sane society, within a minute, the police would have been there with bullhorns, battering rams, machine guns, dogs. I don't care what. They would have busted through the front window with a car. But no, they didn't believe her. Then they set up a perimeter. They ordered coffee. Maybe a bagel came in from the local deli. Maybe they consulted the ACLU playbook on how to deal with the hostage crisis. They could have even brought in a lawyer from Yale to tell them what to do. That's right. They could have gotten a lawyer out of a local university, Yale, to tell the police what they could do, what they couldn't do, not to act. They didn't know. And then, of course, the girls were being raped as they talked. And then the house was set on fire. And the rest is history. So there are many, many aspects to the story. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I guess we're talking about Obama's dangerous inexperience. I guess we're talking about the shocking incompetence of this administration. And I guess we're asking ourselves, how did they get away with it? The man is running around like a child with someone else's credit cards, bankrupting his parents' accounts. It's unbelievable. How in the world does anyone think this is going to end? The man is using our tax dollars going forward 50 years as though it's his private bank. He's trampling on our nation's treasury in a way that exceeds all of the presidents that have preceded him. He is like King Ludwig II of Bavaria, for those of you who have read the history of King Ludwig II of Bavaria. Remember, Obama was never a businessman. All he did was go to Harvard on affirmative action, and they gave him the Harvard Law Review as a plum in order to make him look even better. Nobody ever said no to Obama, ever. He has had no criticism in his life. Do you understand that? Does anyone really understand who this man is? The skids were greased for him from the time he was a child. Everybody said yes to him. Nobody said no. Nobody ever criticized him. He does not do well with criticism. And so he always evades and changes the subject. The U.S. Marines are called Leathernecks for a reason. And the reason is the U.S. Navy was created to fight pirates, again, Muslim pirates at that, in the early 1800s. We had no Navy, but we had merchant ships. We were a young nation, lots of trade going on. We had ships going into that dangerous area. And pirates from Africa would raid the merchant ships and kill the crews and take the cargo. So the merchants of early America demanded that the government help them. And unlike the government of today, the government created the U.S. Navy to help the merchants. The Navy was a warship. It was very fast. It was ironclad. And it had men on it called U.S. Marines. They were on the ship to fight the pirates with swords and flintlocks. And they had leather necks put on their necks, swaths of leather, to protect their necks against the pirates' sword blows. The thing is, though, when they caught pirates, they didn't bring them back to Boston or Washington for a trial. They gutted them and threw them to the sharks. It definitely eliminated piracy in the seas. How have we devolved to such a point that we have the most powerful navy on the earth with people running it who are afraid to fire a shot? Answer. Well, the answer is there is no answer. There is no answer. Certain things there's no answer to. So what are you looking forward to in the future under Obama? What do you think is going to happen in this country in 1 year, in 2 years, in 3 years? Remember, he's young yet, and he's just done his first victory lap. He's just done his first victory lap. What do you think is going to happen after lap number two, lap number three, lap number four? Will it be a benign European-style socialist nation? Will it be something more sinister along the lines of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, with the middle class being driven out of America with their property seized by the government? Or will it fall into a total fascist state of socialism along the lines of some of the fascist socialist states that have existed in the last century and exist right now? That's simple. It certainly isn't going to be the America that your father grew up in. It's certainly not going to be an America where hard work got you somewhere. And we know all of that. So what do you think is coming to this country? Many people are frightened of this man, and they're rightly frightened of this man.
See the pyramids along the Nile. Watch the sunrise on a tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while you belong to
it me. Is a song from another time.
See,
when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. Joe Stafford singing, what a beautiful song, God in heaven. All right, turn it off, right? I don't want to get schmaltzeroo here. Early 50s, I remember my sister used to play the upright piano. We had a little apartment, one bedroom. How many of us slept in the one bedroom? Mom and Dad were in one bed. I was in a bed. Sister was in a bed. Brother was in a crib. Grandmother was in the small, teeny little so-called living room. And they had a piano and there was music in the house. It was civilization. I doubt very much that all immigrants are the same. I kind of doubt that all cultures are the same. I kind of doubt that all people will produce the America that we wish. That's kind of what I'm talking about. We know that. Nobody spoke, nobody told us to speak anything but English in the house. Now, my grandmother didn't speak English. She didn't know it. But we were told never to speak a foreign language in that house. We were taught that you had to speak English. Now, compare that with the immigrants who come here and spit on our language, wave their flag at sporting events, and tell us that we owe them. Can you imagine this?
Savage.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I save my pennies and I save my dimes.
I'm going to make a commitment today on the Savage Nation to avoid anything that is within the alimentary canal from the front to the end. We will nothing to do with anything to do with the alimentary canal for the moment. I'm going to talk about cars, classic cars. I went to a classic car show. I'm more or less a recluse, as you well know. I pride myself on reclusiveness. Now, there are younger guys who are hungry. And they need to make a buck, and they're everywhere. They're the Zelligs of the media. Wherever you turn, there they are. This Tea Party, that Tea Party. It's important stuff. Everywhere you turn, Fox News, CNN, Bill Markowitz's show, everywhere you turn, there are Zelligs in the media appearing every day in every way. Now, that's fine. I don't do it. I never like to do it, and I don't want to do it. So I basically stay in my house in pajamas, except for the occasional bicycle ride or the occasional car show or the miserable trip to a restaurant, which I always regret. Now, there's a secondary note to all of this talking here on the Savage Nation. I stayed in bed most of the weekend, and I feel great. My mind feels better. I feel calmer. I can think. So I went to a car show, the Marin Sonoma Classic Car Show out in the Marin, where was it? An outdoor thing. And I was astounded at the love for vehicles that I saw there, including my own. I mean, I can remember the cars that were there, some of them, the Duesenbergs, the 59 Vet, the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLs, the Bentley Continental from 1961, the Pierce Arrows, the 56 Continental, the 56 T-Bird. I mean, see, if I just mention the names of these cars to most of you, they actually symbolize to you various images come to your mind. And if I say to you, I saw the most amazingly beautiful 1957 Chrysler 300D, and I couldn't take my eyes off it, you'll understand what I'm saying. But, you know, it's funny. Of all the cars I saw there, I had a friend I ran into, an old mechanic friend of mine. He used to fix my old Jaguars, which always broke down. He took a picture of me in front of one car. I only asked him to take a picture of me and Teddy in front of one car. It was a Model T Ford Roadster. It was so beautiful. And I wanted to picture myself in front of the Model T only because I used to build them out of plastic when I was a kid. And it just reminded me. I remember the hard rubber wheels. It all came back to me. But what I'm getting at was the crowd at the auto show. And I was thinking about a few things as I walked around looking at these stunningly gorgeous cars. I could not get out of my head, what would the Obamaites be thinking? That's all I was thinking. What would these hardcore leftist freaks in the White House think of a classic car show such as the one I went to the over the weekend? And all I could think about was these mean monsters from Harvard, these undereducated pinheads, would sort of not only look down upon classic car shows such as this, but that in the future they might ban this sort of show because the cars were not green enough, or that only people with money could afford cars like this. And I started thinking as I walked around looking at these incredible classic cars, what do you think it is about car shows that angers progressives? And then I was going to ask you, do you still have a love affair with cars, or are they just box transportation to you? And then I was going to say, what does the way a person takes care of their car say about their politics? And do liberals drive differently than conservatives? I can say for sure. Genuinely, when I'm cut off, it's a lame brain with an Obama bumper sticker from the right lane. One after the other, and it's usually older women who have been disappointed in life. Either their husbands left them or they were never married, or whatever it is. They generally still drive around with the Obama, you know, for president bumper sticker in some kind of econo box, and they usually try to cut you off from the right lane, and when you don't let them in, they get furious. Like, we have merging lanes in certain parts of the area where I live. Inevitably, they know the right lane merges into the left, they know it's coming to a dead end, and it's always the, quote, nice liberals who try to speed up in the right lane. And I don't know, I won't let them in. I won't let them in. I'm a very competitive person. I don't like being cut off. So I give Wilhelm the gas, and Wilhelm gives them the fume. And they get cut off to the, you know, like, screw you. I mean, what do you mean? You're going to cut me off because you're a nice person? Because you have an Obama bumper sticker? So the cars. You know, you want to talk about cars. I don't know if you want to talk about it. You want me to get into the whole politics? Hello? That is why I'd rather talk about Janis Joplin's psychedelic-themed 1965 Porsche 356 Cabriolet. I have never been a Porsche fan. I never owned one. I never wanted to own one. I don't know what it is. Maybe the Nazi thing. I don't really know. It can't be the Nazi thing because I own a Mercedes, and that was so long ago. Who cares anyway? I mean, I love Mercedes-Benz. It's the best car I ever owned in my life. It's all I drive. I told you I have fancy cars, and I have unfancy cars. My daily driver is an S600 Mercedes. I gave it a name, Wilhelm. I don't drive around saying Wilhelm. I don't talk to it. I'm generally either driving or talking to my dog, Teddy. But the fact of the matter is, after I got this car, I never, ever needed a sports-type car. And I do own a Ferrari, a 430. I rarely, if ever, drive it. But the funny thing is that after I saw the Testarossa and the other Ferraris at the fairgrounds yesterday, actually, even though it was cloudy and horrible and miserable weather, I went all the way to a garage where I keep it, took the cover off it, and took the Ferrari for drive, because the color itself, the Ferrari red in the gray, was astoundingly beautiful. But I'm not one of these guys with the top down making believe I'm enjoying the sun. I don't know. I still don't understand that part of it. Do you? I can't understand it. Whenever there's a hot, sunny day, you see people with the top down. They're enjoying the sun. And I ask myself, did they go to the fifth grade? Did they don't understand the relationship between the sun and skin cancer, especially amongst white men over the age of 13? I mean, what are they thinking? A convertible's nice for a night, a warm, balmy night in Miami, but not for the day. What do you need sun on your face for? It's to show off. That's all it is. Now, who in this day and age thinks anyone who drives around in a convertible is rich or a celebrity? Does anyone, can you answer that question? Most of the so-called loser celebrities in Hollywood drive Priuses anyway. I know that for a fact because I go to L.A. an awful lot. They wouldn't be seen dead in a new car other than a some kind of hybrid. You know, hybrid. All the lowbrows are in hybrids. I love that one. But that's it. I mean, there's a lot to be said for a Rolls Royce. A Rolls Royce in this economy? Yeah. Hello. Yes, if a man earned the money and he bought a Rolls Royce and he loves the Rolls Royce, who are you to tell him he can't drive the Rolls Royce? He's paid a gas guzzler tax. That's not enough, though, for Cass Sunstein from Harvard, whose father taught him over a seltzer and corned beef how to take over the world with lies, in my humble opinion. I'm so sick of these communists, you have no idea. That's why I don't want to talk about them. I don't want to even dignify these communists from Harvard, these losers who have never created a product or a service that anybody wants.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You want me to tell you what happened at the museum, a night at the museum? I'm not sure you want to hear about the exhibit, the closed, it had never been open to the public, Birth of Impressionism. So I went, I was invited, because I happen to love Impressionist paintings. Who doesn't? We all grew up on them. I mean, everybody grew up on Impressionist paintings. Everybody who went to college had to study the Impressionists, right? And so many of you say, ah, that's passe. We don't look at it anymore. Who needs it? We know all about it. You don't know all about it. In fact, I went there and found three new paintings that I didn't know existed. I take that back. I did know they existed. One of them I knew existed. The Floor Scrapers from 1875 by Calabot. Unbelievable. Raboteurs de Parquet, to show you I know French. The Magpie by Monet, 1868. And then most important to me, which was the painting that was very political, The Escape of Rochefort by Manet. Now, why did that painting have any relevance for me? The Escape of Rochefort. I'm going to read this to you for 1 minute, and then we'll move on to straight politics. But I want to read this to you. It caught me. It's basically a picture of a sea. And in the midst of this big painting of a sea, there's a small picture of men in a rowboat. And you read it. Edouard Manet, The Escape of Rochefort. 1881. And just listen to the paragraph. It doesn't matter whether you went to college or not. Henri Rochefort founded the controversial political journal La Lanterne, The Lantern, and was actively opposed to the imperial regime of Napoleon III. Sounds like Obama I, doesn't it? This led to his involvement in the Paris Commune, for which he was imprisoned. Press freedom, anyone? Manet depicts Rochefort's daring escape from a French prison colony in New Caledonia. Intended for the Salon of 1881, Manet's political commentary transforms the recent past into modern history. Amen, does it ever. It's interesting to me that they didn't kill political opponents. They didn't send out Secret Service agents or secret agents to spy on them. Well, they arrested them and they, you know, excommunicated them, in this case to New Caledonia, which you have to understand how far away New Caledonia is and how far away New Caledonia was from Paris in the 1880s. If you've been to any part of the South Pacific, you realize it may as well be the end of the world. That he escaped is astounding. But that brings us front and center to today, which is the art of today. Art of today, from the political, it's become the polemical. I'm going to ask you a simple question. You don't have to be educated. You don't have to like art to answer this question, right? Here's the question. Can you name one artist in the United States of America? Name one. You can't. Can you name any artist from France who speaks today for France? Can you name one German artist? No, you don't know of any because there are none. It doesn't mean there aren't people who are painting, there aren't people who are sculpting, there are. But there are no prominent artists in any Western nation. So you say, wait a minute, how did this happen? How did we wind up in a place where there are no artists that we know of? How come we don't know of an artist in America? Can you name one scientist in America? You can't. How come there's not one prominent scientist? In other words, if you look back 50 years, you all heard of Jonas Salk. You heard of a physicist named Albert Einstein. You know what I'm saying? The giants. How come there are no giants in the sciences, the arts today? There's an answer to that as well. In my opinion, I have the answer for that. It has to do with liberalism. Liberalism deconstructed the entire West, all of Western civilization, and destroyed it. And the reason they deconstructed Western civilization is to enable themselves to reconstruct it in the image of a gigantic new Sovietized world where there is no art except art which serves the state. Witness the Obama posters during the campaign, where there is no science other than science which supports the government. Do you follow what I'm saying to you? You have to understand where I'm coming from to understand what I'm saying at all. So I attended an art show at the De Young Museum, classical paintings from the Impressionist era, and I was again taken in by their beauty. But I ask you, where in America today are such works of art being created? Can you name one artist today that creates works of art on the level of a Degas or Renoir? Well, what's amazing is that even the art of that era was sometimes political, as I just showed you. But in the world of art, we've gone from the political to the polemical. Can you think of a single artist today whose art is intended to uplift instead of to offend? Can you think of an artist who describes instead of degrades? Can you think of an artist who reveres instead of reviles America? There's no one. No Western nation currently produces great artists or sculptors, and it's because of the same left-wing ism that has destroyed our political system. The very same left that would laud a loser like Woody Allen, who wishes that there would be a dictatorship where Obama could be a dictator if it wasn't for those nasty Republicans. This is from a Jew. This is from a liberal Jew who wishes for a dictatorship. This is why I've told you years ago that you actually shouldn't fear these people. You should pity them. Liberalism is a mental disorder, a very serious one. What Woody Allen doesn't know is that when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, and that was a dictatorship, I guess that was a bad dictatorship. It certainly was, but to Woody Allen, there was only one bad dictatorship. That was that of Nazi Germany. But I guess the Soviet Union had a good dictatorship under Stalin. Now, what did the Germans do? The Nazis took many of the great works of art, which they considered to be degenerate, and removed them from museums, particularly the art of Jews. They took away the art of Chagall, Kandinsky, and they removed them from public view, but they didn't destroy them. No, did they? Not at all. Ironically, those paintings and many other classical works of art were stolen and hoarded by high-ranking officials of the Nazi regime. Now, what happened in Russia is after the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks tried to put all art into the service of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Stalin issued a decree, quote, on the reconstruction of literary and art organizations, and only art in the, quote, socialist realism style was allowed. What does this have to do with America today? Well, listen, the Nazis and the Soviets were both socialist regimes. Never be deceived. We know the Soviets were socialist, that you know, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. But you didn't know that the Nazis were socialist until I told you this 4 years ago. And they allowed only art that fell in line with their extreme political agenda. And what did they do? They depicted muscled factory workers and overalls struggling in a steel foundry, or heroic visions of soldiers hearkening back to the Roman Empire. These paintings, posters, and sculptures were propaganda, not real art. And so you go even to China under Mao Zedong. Remember the peasant posters of the noble peasant working in the field? Again, that's an example of state-sponsored art. And what's happening today? That's the real question. Well, what's happening today is that real art has been hollowed out and replaced with garbage that serves the needs of the state. Do you realize that great art is by its very nature conservative? That crap art is by its very nature liberal? A great painting conserves a moment in time or an emotion so that it can be experienced by future generations. The conservative bees build up the hive. The progressive termites tear down the hive. They critique art, they impose meanings upon it that are designed to further their far-left political agendas. And so the art that is created by leftists is destructive. For example, a painting of the Virgin Mary in elephant dung, a crucifix in a jar of urine, or a mindless repetition of images such as Andy Warhol's soup cans. Why was that designed? What is it designed for? Well, all of those pieces of dreck were designed to render the very structure of art meaningless. Remember, the goal of liberal, postmodern, deconstructive art is to tear down the old institutions like the Catholic Church, the family, the nation, and replace them with chaos. And then in that chaos, there is an environment ripe for takeover by a monolithic dictatorial view of culture in which only one opinion on an issue is allowed, and that is the opinion of the government. And in the world of art, this means giant posters of the great leader mounted on every empty wall, as we saw with the Obama posters that appeared in 2008. In the political world, it means a dictatorship, the kind of dictatorship that Woody Allen and other so-called members of the progressive art community wish Obama had. The left has deconstructed art, and now the left is trying to deconstruct our nation as well.
Savage.
I'm gonna raise a fuss, I'm gonna raise a holler about a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says,
no dice, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime.
So I go to the car show, the classic car show. My favorite, actually, there's a number of favorites, a 57 Chrysler 300D. Unbelievable. The big Hemi engine with the twin carbs, twin four-barrel carbs. I say to my friend Alan, are they hard to keep together? He said, no, not at all. He said, he's a mechanic who's done this for 40, 50 years. I don't know how long. He said, no, they're very easy to maintain. He said, these older cars are very easy to maintain. They were much easier than the new ones. There was a 49 CAD convertible, a light green. Oh, my God, I love that car. I really always wanted like a 53 Caddy convertible. I mean, I could buy one, but I don't, because it's just more to take care of. But I realized my love affair with engines and cars and why liberals hate them. Why do liberals hate, for example, the Indy 500? Why do they hate stock car racing? Why do they hate everything to do with cars? Well, there's a number of reasons. One, let's stick to the classic car. The reason libs hate classic car shows is they represent two things that libs detest. They represent affluence, that you have enough money to maintain a car like this, and you take pleasure in showing it to somebody. That's number one. That's so unliberal. And number two, freedom. It represents the freedom to do what the hell you want with your money, not send it to Indonesia after an earthquake, for example. Like, you know, let the government take care of it. It's not my problem. Stop demanding I take care of the whole world. I really don't care about the whole world. I'd rather buy a 1957 Chrysler 300D, if you don't mind. And then, of course, it's the green thing. You know, the big greens, the liars. They fly all over the world to protest a little too much, as far as I am concerned. Let's talk about other things. My sermon. 3 pages. 2 pages. 1 minute. Thousands of years ago, a little-known man in a Middle Eastern desert, tried to lead his people from idolatry and hatred. Today, the descendants of these original tribes of Israel are known as Jews. What, we ask, is a Jew? Is it a religion, a race, a mindset? It is, to me, a constant relationship with God, the eternal Creator. A constant dialogue within ourselves, asking, pleading, demanding, to know why the God will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy... why the good will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy the riches of their plunder. It is this ability to ask without hearing an answer, but to keep asking eternal questions without losing faith in goodness and godness. It is this desire to want to hear the very voice of God without hearing it. It is coming to know that the questions themselves are God's way, which makes the Jewish spirit an eternal manifestation of that transcendental experience in the desert thousands of years ago, which gives each Jewish person a special destiny, a special burden. What is it? To waste the spark of the fire of original knowledge is to throw away not only your own destiny and inheritance, but a portion of the destiny and inheritance of the people chosen by God to be his bearers of the light. Being human and not God, we all sin by missing the mark, and that is my message to my friends gathered here tonight on the Savage Nation. In Hebrew, the word sin does not exist. Did you know that? It does not exist. It translates closely to miss the mark, for God is forgiving, or not one of us listening to the show today would survive a single day. The message is to try to hit the mark again and again. That is the Zen of maintaining the inheritance of God. Seek truth, seek justice. So Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, marks the beginning of 10 days of awe, a period during which the Jewish people are judged by God, who decides whether they will be inscribed in the book of life for the coming year. It is an intense time for Jewish people, a time of trial and forgiveness. It concludes with Yom Kippur, a day of repentance. And so, as we leave the savage speech and we go into the wilderness of our own lives, I want to wish every listener to this show to remember this. Be happy. God made you. God loves you. Why does Karzai continue to wear that Boy Scout cap? I don't get it. What is that Cub Scout uniform? You know, that's so, like, third world outfitty. I mean, we know he's the president of a third world nation. Let's talk about Afghanistan for a minute now that I got your attention. I'm glad I got your attention. Can anyone explain to me why are we in Afghanistan? Because I still don't know. Why are men dying? Why are men fighting? Why are men getting maimed? For whom? For whom the bell tolls and why? Americans want us out of Afghanistan, incidentally. Now you say, oh, I'm shocked to hear that. We thought you were right wing. Don't you understand who I am yet? Don't you get who I am yet? Why are we in Afghanistan? I thought Obama was a peacenik. He comes to power and he increases the troop strength by 30,000. And to top it all off, in addition to increasing the war in Afghanistan, which we're not winning because of rules of disengagement, did you hear that they're actually giving medals for not fighting? Hold fire and earn a medal. You didn't hear this story. You're not going to believe it. You thought the rules of engagement under Bushki were bad. You're right. But U.S. troops in Afghanistan could soon be awarded a medal for not doing something. It would be given for courageous restraint, for holding fire to save civilian lives. I cannot believe what I'm looking at. It's as if they're saying American men are trigger happy and they go out of their way to kill civilians. You know that the enemy hides amongst their wives and children. You know that. So this is shocking that we have a military that's been turned into such putty by the liberals.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
We're talking now about cars and boats and planes and how much I love machines and how I went to the classic car show. I don't go to car shows, but I did, and I realized what I'm missing. And it takes a lot of work to keep these cars, you know, looking so beautiful, I guess. They truck them there, a lot of them. I was amazed that they sat in the hot sun and they let them sit without tenting them. I was quite surprised, you know, that kind of thing. So why do liberals hate classic cars is an interesting question. All I could think about as I walked around the fairgrounds looking at the beautiful cars was liberals and why they would love to ban this sort of gathering and how they'd like to turn these cars into, recycle them into sort of, homeless shelters or something. I couldn't believe it. It's like two different universes, you know. Caterpillar C18 diesels, unbelievable engines. Unbelievable engines. You know, my boat just gets up and, you know, you got this 40-ton boat. You're doing 8 knots, 7 knots, 9 knots. You get her out through the Raccoon Straits, and you're heading out toward the bridge. If there are no pesky sailors or pesky the sailboats I can dodge, at least I could see them, but the schmucks on the kayaks I can't stand. They're as stupid as bicyclists on country roads. What do they have in their heads, these morons in kayaks? You're going out in a kayak in an open waterway, and there are boats, and we're supposed to see you in a turbulent bay, and you won't put a flag on the back of your schmuck kayak, your Nanook of the sea? How did you get your schmuck kayak to the water, I like to ask the putts? You put it on your stupid SUV and brought it there, idiot. But all of a sudden, you missed the purity. Now, I don't mind if a guy kayaks, but keep it to the side of the damn bay or put a flag on the back of your thing so no one runs you over. So I go out and I see the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I want to head out to the sea. So I open the engines up. That boat jumps 40 tons. If I slam the throttles forward, I don't slam them. I push them forward. I don't like stressing an engine any more than I stress myself. I grade up fast, though, and I go to, let's say, 2,200 RPM, and you'll see this boat move from 8 knots to 20 knots, 22 knots, like a fast speedboat. Think of it, 40 tons, and it'll move like that. Yes, the fuel consumption's enormous. A Cat C18, which runs about 1,000 horsepower each, you got 2,000 horsepower. When you're running at 2,300 RPM, you're burning about 52 gallons an hour on each engine. So let's say 100 gallons an hour on the boat. So that's your business? Who's paying for it, schmuck? You? I'm paying for it. You know how much of that is tax? A lot of it. If I want to burn 100 gallons an hour, that's my business. It's not your business. It's my business. That's how I see it.
When I take her to the track, she really shines.
Giddy up, 4-9. Any topic is a fair game, I suppose.
Giddy up, 4-9. My four-speed dual quad positive traction, 409.
Savage.